Our first panelist is Beth from South Carolina, and I'll turn it over to Beth. Can you see me okay? Good morning, everyone. My name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic. It's truly an honor to be here. It's real. You know, I've been thinking about this for over a year, and when they asked me to share my experience, strength, and hope, I mean, it was truly an honor, but it felt surreal at the time. Well, anyway, my sobriety birthday is October 8th, 1992. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and so on. I don't currently have any sponsees. The last one I had was back in January. I just moved to South Carolina from Rochester, New York, and I still have Rochester listed on my badge, so that's wrong. And I was encouraged to find a new sponsor once I moved. I've been back to visit a few times, finalize business and things like that. And I met my sponsor, and she admitted to me that she had started smoking pot the same day I left. Wow. And that's between her and her higher power. But I felt like it was important to share that. So at this point, I'm open for a temporary sponsorship. So today we're going to talk about the traditions in sobriety, and there's a lot to talk about. When I first came into the fellowship, I wasn't interested in the traditions. I didn't understand them. I didn't see the point. I didn't understand the steps either at that time. I was too angry. I didn't want to be labeled an alcoholic. I'd been through some situations that had led to me coming into AA. And I was pretty much full of ego at the time. So I wasn't interested in being branded one of you. But I had to. You know how it is. Keep coming back. So I kept going to meetings. I kept going to meetings. And eventually I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. And I kept coming back. And the reason I kept coming back was because of the 12-step program, because there was so much love and so much higher power in the rooms. My home life, the circumstances of my life were very chaotic at the time, and I was full of fear and emotion. And when I would go into the rooms, I felt love. I felt the love in the air, and that's the reason that I kept coming back, because it was such a relief to be in a place where I was understood and where I understood. So after a while, I worked after working my 12 steps, I started getting involved in service work, because that's what I was told to do. I made coffee, I set up the chairs, I chaired the meetings. I did all levels of service in my meeting, but there was still something missing. I wasn't fully involved until I started to understand the traditions. And that was a process for me. Oh, I do need to mention, I have a new home group that I just started going to. It's Wade Hampton, the Wade Hampton group, rather, in Greenville, South Carolina. It's a really great group. They provide interpreting services. In fact, they're the only meeting that does. So if you happen to be in town, come see us. It's funny because as time got near to do this panel, I realized that I needed to actually review the traditions. So I threw out some topics for discussion about the 12 traditions and asked for other people's personal favorites, their stories, and I really enjoyed the sharing that we had. I didn't realize how much I really appreciate the traditions, how much more appreciation I have for them. So I want to talk a little bit about tradition number one, because as a deaf person, when I first came in, I was full of resentment because everybody looked at me as a deaf person first. When I would go up to people and greet them, they would say to me, "I don't know sign language." You know how people gesture when they don't know how to communicate with you? You've probably seen it. You've probably done it. And so I started going to meetings where other deaf people were, and I felt better about that because I had community, but the unity that's talked about in Tradition 1, the unity of the AA structure, was missing for me. I wasn't part of yet. And so I tried to share the message that I'm just one of you. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just as sick as anybody else. I'm just a drunk. But I realized that the more that I got involved and the more that I was sharing my own experience, strength, and hope, and my own issues, and as I did more work in the steps, the more I did those things, it was like a ripple effect. And I became an alcoholic first rather than a deaf person first, or a woman first, or whatever other identifier I might have. I also want to talk a little bit about Tradition 12 because, as I mentioned, I came in full of fear, full of resentment, and I judged. I took everybody's inventory. I'm better than that person because I know more than they do, and they just don't understand, and this person talks too much, and you know how it is. Whatever it was, I was judging it. And I imagine when I first came in and was doing that, that's just how it was. But after a time, as I got more involved and was working the steps, I started to realize how we're all just drunks, and that's the end of it. And if I'm judging you, what am I doing to myself? Because as I'm pointing to you, there are three times as many fingers pointing backward at me. So if I'm worried about somebody talking too much, and I start to get all bent out of shape, that means that there's something wrong with me, that I'm probably talking too much myself. Now, the concept of principles before personalities at first made no sense to me. It was one I had to grow into. It means when I come into a 12-step meeting, I just need to do whatever it is that my higher power directs me to do. Whether it's action, whether it's saying something. And that's an example of our unity. That my personal issues, my control issues, and I have to admit, I'm a little bit of a control freak. I like things to go my way. Those are the things that I have to continually push aside in order for the unity of the fellowship. I have to push aside my need for things to be a certain way. And the more I do that, the more I'm in line with the program. And if something goes awry, that's between whoever's involved and their higher power. That's between you and the God of your understanding. And if I do have a disturbance, of course I need to talk to my sponsor. And I can imagine my sponsor's going to tell me to write an inventory. Have you inventoried it yet? Yeah, that's always the question. I love my sponsor. And about anonymity, it's the spiritual foundation of all our principles. I want to talk a little bit about that too, because I was sharing about that with somebody. And, you know, many years ago, I thought that anonymity meant that we were secret, that we couldn't say anything about who we saw in meetings, which is one thing, yes. But I really didn't understand the meaning of anonymity. It really means that we're all the same. That no person is better than another, that nobody's name is more important than anybody else's. So let's say that I drive to a meeting and I arrive just a little bit late because this has happened before. And I end up having to park way out in the parking lot. My van ends up with dings and fender bump. The bumpers are all scraped or whatever. And I end up parking next to, let's say, a BMW. And it's full-on blinged out, shiny and pretty. And I look in the parking lot and I see all of the other vehicles. And they're newer than mine. You've got those Nissans and those Fords. And some of them might be really crappy like mine. And some of them might be just off the lot. And some of them might be an old jalopy. And you might have old pick-em-up trucks that have been painted with house paint. But as I walk into the meeting and I look at the parking lot, once I get in the meeting and look around the room, I'm not able to know who's got the shiny blinged out vehicle versus who's got the old jalopy. Because we're all the same. We're all essentially one person. We're all alcoholics. We're just a bunch of drunks. And so there's no show of classism or elitism. There's no judging based on that. And so that's my understanding of what anonymity means today. With that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. That was a beautiful presentation. Now we would like to honor the next speaker. This is Art. He's from California. All right, Art, off to you.
Cameraman, can you please close up on Art on the video? Thank you.
My sponsor is here now watching me. Hi, my name is Art, and I'm an alcoholic. I've been a member of AA since 1981, and I've been sober since July the 25th. 1999. I'd like to talk about the 12 traditions. And in 1982, I wanted to set up an AA group for deaf participants only. We had a big discussion about it, and we all took a vote, and we voted a president in and a vice president in. Yeah, I do remember that, yes. It was a long time ago. You know, there were several old-timers who were like, you know, we don't need a president or a vice president, and we said we should have somebody run the meetings, and they said, no, you know, we don't need a secretary, we don't need anyone. I mean, I was a little bit confused about that structure. And we had no governor of the group or anything like that. There was no one to manage it. And I really didn't understand what's going on. Okay. All right. Okay. Is that better? Okay. You know, the only thing that was required of membership was the desire to stop drinking. And we went in to the meeting, you know, and if a person came in drunk, we thought that we should kick them out of the meeting. And I found that I was mistaken, that was not actually the case. There were some other people there that were drunk as well. So it was, a place where I had to learn a lot more. And we discussed that we, you know, had, we were self-supporting and we had, we didn't have anything to promote the group and we didn't do anything for selling and we were wanted to. We wanted to sell t-shirts and things like that, but they told us no. And the seventh tradition, in raising the money, we wanted to be able to have a party. And they said no to that as well. So I'm, and that group was a complete failure. It didn't continue because we didn't follow the 12 traditions. We really did not understand what the 12 traditions meant. So I'd like to ask you right now if you would raise your hand and show me who knows the 12 traditions. Let me see. 8, 9, 12, 12, you know, a small group, but it's a small people who really understand the 12 traditions in this room, a small group of folks. And when I came into a meeting, you know, I mean, I relapsed off and on, and the reason was because I didn't really understand the traditions totally, especially step number two. And then one day I met a person who was Latino, and they couldn't speak English, and so we would gesture to each other. And I started to learn the second tradition, and that person finally got it through to me that I had a clearer understanding of the second step through them. My third sponsor, his name was Mike. He was familiar with the traditions, the concept of the traditions, and the 12 concepts. And he taught me a tremendous amount about those concepts. The AA group that I went to was small in San Diego. They were a small group. And several times they ceased to be. They would just close up because we didn't have a GSR. You know, we didn't have any understanding of how to keep the group alive. So then we decided to have a vote to be able to have a GSR, to have a local GSR to be able to help us when we were in times of trouble to mediate for us, to bring information to the area level, to exchange that with our group. And it really helped our group a lot. And they voted me in as the GSR for the district. For District 6 and 19. And we separated into two groups. And so through my frustrations and struggles, I started to learn a lot more. And I, you know, when I looked at my home group at that time and took an assessment of them, I realized that we needed to learn more about the 12 traditions. And that we needed to accept everyone in order to have unity. And we needed to invite anyone into our group, regardless. And there was a question of could a hearing person come? And we all said yes unanimously that could happen with an interpreter. Sorry. And there was one deaf person who was homeless. And, you know, it didn't matter what kind of trouble they were in or they were homeless or what their needs were. They just needed to be in the group, and we accepted them without question. There was no talk about it. There was no discussion. We welcomed them with open arms. And so our group started to make tremendous improvements. And I think I remember we had maybe less than 5 members in our home group. And, I mean, we were very slow to really expand. We were really limited in the number of members that we had. And on the seventh tradition, you know, we were really thankful to the state of Washington for, they gave us the, gave what?
Yeah, the gold can.
Gold can.
Gold can plan, yep.
The gold can plan. To be able to collect funds for interpreters.
That was kept separate
from the group funds. The seven traditions had budgetary monies that were kept aside to be able at the area level. And so the gold can was used within the group meetings to be able to collect those funds. and it was very successful. It really helped our group grow. And we would have, you know, two or three people maybe come a week, and then meetings a week, and then eventually we got up to 8 meetings a week. Sometimes anonymity was broken, of course. What can we say? You know, we had to teach each other, and there were lots of complaints, but I just kept out at the heart of the matter until our group began to mature and build and become more bonded. And now my home group, we have about 20 members, maybe 20 or more members, because of the 12 traditions. That's the key to being able to have a group keep going and to gain more members. Actually, the sixth tradition is really key. We don't lend finance or our name to other groups. And we do not lend funds to other 12-step, to other AA groups that want to be able to use our funds for an interpreter. We keep those funds separate. We also do not allow other entities into our group. And we have our funds collected through donations, and money for interpreters is donated as well. And if there is no funding, there's always the question as to how we're going to pay for the interpreters. And we want to make sure that we keep the funding available for the seven traditions and to support AA and our group. So we do a group collection for the interpreters, and it's worked. And I believe that AA can pay for interpreters. And self-supporting, I believe it can work. And sharing the message with other people. I remember with the GSR at the time, we had an area discussion, and the discussion was very long. The meeting was about 8 hours, and people had lots of issues that they wanted to talk about. The primary issue, though, that they wanted to talk about was funding related to being able to pay for an interpreters. And to me, the issue was not only money. I told the group that I said, listen, we cannot support the sponsorship of interpreters, then I believe the deaf community is really going to suffer, and we need the 12 traditions taught to the deaf community. And they finally, through me speaking up, they did pass this resolution and accept it, that we would have that ongoing sponsorship no matter what happened. And when I first came in, I didn't believe in God. And the more I went to AA meetings, since 1999, it's been amazing. And I want to thank you to Bill W., who wrote the 12 traditions. And you have 5 minutes? I think I'll add 5 minutes to the last speaker's part. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. Our next, last but not least speaker is Mel T. from Maryland. Hi, everyone. I'm Mel. I'm an alcoholic. Wow, it's so inspiring to be here. And hi. People are waving at me from the audience. Nice. Great. Okay. As was mentioned, I'm from Maryland. My sobriety birth date is January 22nd, 1997. And I got sober in Michigan, which is my home. Yay, Michigan! Yeah, good! So I got sober in Michigan in rehab. I was in and out of rehab. I was relapsing probably for the first 4 or 5 years of my recovery. And my journey is a slow one because I'm a slow learner. I tried to avoid working the steps. I liked staying in my comfort zone where things were familiar. And anytime new things would come in, I would balk. I didn't want to do them. I didn't want the drama or the complication of working the steps. You know, because most of us come into the program and the first thing we do is to try and figure out how not to drink, right? We're trying to avoid alcohol. We don't focus on the 12 steps. Maybe we do eventually, but we don't focus on the 12 traditions for sure. Like the first speaker said, like Beth said. So I didn't really talk about the traditions for a long time. At least in Michigan, we didn't. Nobody ever said, okay, before we start sharing, what have you heard about staying in the room? Nobody ever asked that kind of question. So it was the members who taught me about the 12 traditions. And mainly just because I showed up at meetings. Whenever I could have an interpreter, I would go to a meeting. So how did I learn about the traditions? The first one I learned about was tradition number 7. While I was still in Michigan, struggling to stay sober, it got a little bit better because I started working the program. So I was able to get sober for a year. And at that time, I decided to go back to college in D.C. to finish my bachelor's because I had withdrawn my master's, excuse me. I was failing so many classes, and so after a year, I withdrew. I went back home. I took a geographic because, you know, the geographic cure is always going to make things better. I have too much stress in my life at college. I'll go back where I'm safe. And, of course, I drank in Michigan no differently from wherever I was. I drank because I was there. So that's part of my story. My mother was the one who would bust me regularly as I was drinking because I would get home late at night and I would open the door and, of course, I'm bumping into the walls as I'm walking down the hallway and I thought that nobody else knew about this, but my mother would tell me, "No, honey, I could hear you. I'm no fool." And so I was finally kicked out of the house and that was kind of a wake-up call for me. And so I ended up in rehab, and I'm not telling you the part I wanted to tell you about. So the 7th tradition, great. I went back to school, and I needed a meeting, but I didn't know who to reach out to. I was very much alone. I was back in Washington, D.C. at college. And the school I go to is an all-deaf school, and so I thought, you know, I'll try this on my own. I think I can handle a drink. I've been sober for a year. I've got this. This is not going to be a big deal, is it? But I was struggling because the environment at that university was no different from what it had been when I was there before, before I withdrew. It was a party school in many ways, and so temptation was everywhere, and I didn't know a lot of people. Until another graduate student, I came back for my undergrad, but another graduate student came back. And we had done outside issues before I left, and so she invited me to dinner one night. So I went over to her house for dinner, and I should have known better. I mean, come on. I smoked with her before, so why did I accept this dinner invitation? Oh, things will be different. No, they won't. So I went, and of course, there was alcohol. And I relapsed because that's not where I should have been. I should have been at an AA meeting, but I didn't know where any of them were. And so I got on the internet and I looked for AA meetings that provided interpreters. And I was stunned that there weren't any. But at this point, I was desperate. And so I remembered one deaf woman who was an addiction counselor who lived in the D.C. area. And I reached out to her. That was the best thing because she lived right across from the school. And she invited me to her house every day. So what would happen is I would go to class, I would do my studies, and I would immediately go and stay at her house. And my AA meetings were her house. She would invite a few other people who were deaf and who knew and who were alcoholics. And that was my support system. That's how I started out. But when the meetings would open, we would start with a silent prayer, and then each of us would share, and then we'd close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer, if I remember correctly. But it was much more of a social thing. We would eat snacks, and we would talk. And that worked for a while. But we were in her home, and that wasn't going to last forever. It wasn't a neutral location. It was in her house. And so eventually I told her that I was looking for something else. I wanted another meeting, a meeting with other AA members, people who could hear, who didn't sign. I'd just use an interpreter. And she told me that there weren't any meetings like that in the D.C. area anymore, and that I would just have to figure it out. Maybe myself and another deaf person, I think we went to probably almost 10 meetings to see if they could find money enough to pay for interpreting services. And I can't tell you the despair of finding or hearing the answer no over and over and over. No one was willing to help me in my recovery. Until finally I found a group that was willing. They set up funds and they started providing interpreters. And that was one meeting a week. That's all I had, one meeting a week. Imagine if that's all you could go to. That was my program at that time. And so this other deaf member and I were kind of on our own, except for this one meeting. The other member was also new. Neither of us had more than a year of sobriety. And looking back, I don't know how Bill W. and Dr. Bob did it when they were under a year sober, and it was just them. I mean, they helped each other and they made it, but they didn't have anybody to ask to be their sponsor. They were truly pioneers. And in many ways, I felt like I was a pioneer too, and I didn't like it. I wanted somebody to provide me the way. AA owed me, was what I thought. It's like, I'm here, I'm a member, come on, what's wrong with you, AA? My attitude was really bad at the time, but you know what? It still kept me sober. Despite my resentments, despite my belly aching, I still was sober. And that wasn't the solution. I ended up relapsing again, so that wasn't the solution. But I knew I could get sober if I worked at it. And I'm telling you the truth, I didn't enjoy it. But I wanted sobriety. And AA seems to work for other people. I mean, last night, how many flags were in that opening ceremony? People from all over the world are proof that the unity of our fellowship is real. And that's what I wanted. And so I thought, okay, if I just keep coming back, if I just keep chasing this unity. So now I'm here at this convention, and I feel the unity, and it's very moving. I see brothers and sisters in recovery who I know and love, and I know when I get back home, it's not going to be the same. We have a deaf recovery community on Facebook. It's a closed group, and there are arguments about it that people say it's not AA because there are different fellowships represented, but we have to start somewhere. And how the hell are we going to meet each other if we don't find a way to meet each other? Technology today truly has made a huge impact for us in allowing us, because we use a visual nature, allows us to use our language. But that's still touchy because the group's been going for more than 2 years now, and we have about 408 members. The membership fluctuates a little bit, but it never really drops too much. And that's how I've met so many of the brothers and sisters that I know here, is through that Facebook closed group. And I really believe that it's a higher power at work in our group because of our commonality. So in the Deaf Recovery community on Facebook, we have unity. And we agreed about meeting here at the convention. Another sign of unity. And we have people from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, California, people who are newly sober, people who are old-timers, people who are fat, people who are thin. We've got them all here because it's all about the unity. And I really appreciate, and I'll be honest, I'm not a guru of the 12 traditions. The seventh tradition is the first one that I learned about, and I had to. Because when I got to the D.C. area intergroup, myself and the other member went, and we said that we want help. We want interpreting services for more than one meeting a week. How do we solve this problem? My group at the time had a grant. And I'm not actually sure where that grant came from. It might have come from a nonprofit, but it was for the clubhouse that was run as a nonprofit that would host the AA meetings. So it wasn't affiliated. But then the grant ran out. And as that was coming close to happening, we were really worried. And so we went to the Washington Area Intergroup, and they said, Seventh Tradition, that's the answer. And at the time, I didn't understand what that meant. And they said, why don't you deaf folks set up your own meeting? That's self-supporting from your own contributions. You don't need to go to a meeting with an interpreter. Set up your own meeting. And I was confused at the time because I'm trying to look and see, what does this self-supporting through our own contribution Seventh Tradition thing mean? It means that we don't accept outside donations. Oh, okay. Well, my first thought was self-supporting meant, oh, that's too bad. I have to do this on my own, and I can't accept help from other people. That was my first understanding of what this self-contribution thing meant. But then in my group, they talked about what it meant to be self-supporting. And so I talked with them because I wanted to keep coming back. And they had a group conscience. And they also wanted me to keep coming back. They didn't want to lose me as a member, but the issue was funding. How do we pay for the interpreting services? Where do we get the money to cover that? So they talked about possibly doing two pots, one for the rent and one to cover the interpreting services. But the problem is that the meeting wasn't very big. And they paid $25 a week for the rent, and interpreting services are more expensive than that. So it was kind of a, well, let's just do this and see what happens. And we ended up with the interpreter pot being overflowing and the rent pot not being so full, which was a lovely testament that they cared about us as members. I mean, it really made me feel good, I have to be honest. The clubhouse wasn't so happy with us because they weren't getting their rent money, and we were $800 in arrears with them. So that wasn't a solution to the problem either. But that was my first experience with the traditions, was figuring out how to be self-supporting. And I read it say that, I read in 12 and 12, it talks about AA must forever remain poor. Because if we are, I forget exactly how it says it, but if we're rich and we're fundraising and we're self-promoting, we will drink again. Because we will focus on money, property, and prestige versus our primary purpose, which is sobriety. So I really appreciate hearing the other panelists, their experience, Art talking about how their meetings were established. I'm here to learn as much as anybody, and I hope that this can help me solve my own problems back home in D.C., because that's really why I'm here. This is awesome. I'm so glad to be here, and I'll just always keep learning about AA. There's never too much to learn. I saw a person here at the convention that had a tattoo on his arm that said, rule number 62. And I said, what is rule 62? And he said, don't take yourself too damn seriously. That's great advice. It's kind of like tradition 4. That's why I need you. That's how I learn. I learn about the program through my brothers and sisters in recovery. So thank you for your patience with me. Thank you for teaching me. Thank you for accepting me, and thank you for letting me share. With that, I pass.